This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to the January 29th, 2014 edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesday of every month. Every other fifth Wednesday, like today, when I usually open the lines to KZYX listeners to get your takes on the world. Since what would have been my regular program last Wednesday was preempted by Governor Brown's State of the State address, I am instead going to bring you a special report today on a national scandal among whose victims were the city and citizens of Ukiah, whose historic downtown post office, a New Deal era post office, was shut down 2 years ago this month. I include the city itself among the victims because the closing of the post office had served not only as a place to buy stamps, mail, and receive letters and packages in walking distance from downtown, it was also an informal community gathering place, which its replacement on Orchard Avenue is not. On February 23, 2011, the post office announced its intention to close the post office and move its services to the annex at the edge of the city. A public meeting 2 months later drew a standing room only crowd of more than 200 people. Congressman Mike Thompson, who was our congressman then, attended that meeting and provided no help, and the Postal Service bureaucrats who showed up treated their critics with disdain. More Ukiahans might have been there, but postcards announcing the meeting arrived a week after the meeting took place. A petition containing 5,000 signatures opposing the Ukiah closing was of no avail. The Ukiah Post Office was built in 1937, and like so many others around the country, built during the New Deal. It contained a historic mural painted by Ben Cunningham in 1938. It was soon removed from the wall after the sale. Its present location, at least for me, a mystery. Why it was sold and who were the parties responsible for the closing and sale of the School Street Post Office and similar post offices across the country is not, however, a mystery. We should begin with a Congress which in 2006 passed a law required of no other business or federal agency that the Postal Service needed to have on hand sufficient funds to prepay its retiree health benefits 75 years into the future. It was a virtually impossible task, as it was intended to be. Enter the world's largest real estate firm, C.B. Richard Ellis, chaired by Richard Blum, husband of California Senator Dianne Feinstein, whose private equity firm, Blum Capital, is one of CBRE's main stockholders. In 2011, it received an exclusive contract to negotiate the sale of the U.S. Postal Service's $85 billion in assets necessitated by the congressional vote. The following year, the Postal Service informed Congress that more than 600 of its buildings nationwide had been, quote-unquote, earmarked for disposal, and at the moment, 40 post offices nationwide are listed for sale on the post office website. On July 27, 2013, a couple of hundred singing and chanting people demonstrated on the steps of the historic main post office in downtown Berkeley to protest its scheduled closure and sale. The Berkeley City Council had voted unanimously to oppose the sale, and one of its members took the microphone to angrily decry the closure. "The Berkeley crowd is not acting alone," wrote investigative reporter Peter Byrne. "From the beaches of Santa Monica to the avenues of the Bronx to the orange farms of Nalcrest, Florida, people who like the U.S. mail are getting mad," end quote. As Berkeley-based environmental writer Gray Brecken put it in an email to me, "Dealing with the USPS, let alone its bedmate, CBRE, is like dealing with the Kremlin or Kafka's castle, which is why I suspect that outright criminality is involved," end quote, Gray Brecken. Thanks to the intervention of East Bay Congresswoman Barbara Lee, however, the Berkeley Post Office was granted a reprieve 2 weeks ago with the passage of a bipartisan House bill that urged the Postal Service to refrain from selling historic buildings, including Berkeley's, while the U.S. Inspector General investigates whether the agency is violating preservation laws. At 20 minutes past the hour, I'll be speaking with veteran Berkeley educator and activist Harvey Smith about the fight to save the Berkeley Post Office and the forces behind the closing and selling off of other post offices, including the one in Ukiah, which became the poster child for those fighting to prevent their own historic New Deal building from going on the auction block. Until then, I'll give you my version of the War and Peace Report, which seems to have been missing lately. The third week of January was one that neither the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, better known as AIPAC, nor New York's new mayor, Bill de Blasio, are likely to forget. While on Capitol Hill, AIPAC was watching its latest Iran sanctions legislation plan come to what appeared to be a crashing halt, de Blasio was having a Romney moment. In what he believed to be a press-free dinner hosted by AIPAC at Manhattan's Hilton Hotel, he was secretly recorded as saying that part of the job description of being the city's mayor is to be, quote-unquote, a defender of Israel, and that Israel is America's greatest ally, and that AIPAC would always be welcomed in his office. Here's a short clip from that event.
Bill de Blasio.
Good evening, everybody. It is an honor to be here this evening. I honestly feel that part of the job description, this most international of cities, city most connected to the rest of the world, arguably of any city, a special obligation. That is our obligation. And I feel that part of my job description is to be a defender of Israel. There is a philosophical grounding to my belief in Israel, and my belief it is our obligation to defend Israel. But it's also something that is elemental to being an American, because there's no greater ally on earth. And that's something we should say proudly. As mayor, I am committed to not just maintaining an alliance, but strengthening the alliance between Israel and the city of New York, and Israel and the United States of America. And I have to tell you, I'll finish by saying, as mayor of New York City, I want you to know that you have a friend and an ally at City Hall, that City Hall will always be open to AIPAC, that when you need me to stand by you in Washington or anywhere, I will answer the call, and I'll answer it happily, because that's my job.
Bill de Blasio.
Well, in fairness to de Blasio, it should be acknowledged that being, quote, a defender of Israel is part of the unwritten job description of anyone, regardless of color, religion, or sexual orientation, who aspires to a career in U.S. electoral politics. It is, in fact, that AIPAC contacts every viable candidate for federal office, be they Democrat or Republican, and obtains a statement pledging her his loyalty to Israel, which is then passed on to prospective donors, but rarely to the general public. That applied as much to Senator Elizabeth Warren as it did to her own Jared Huffman, and both complied. But things may be a-changing. Certainly no one has doubted the affection for Israel either of California's two senators, Barbara Boxer and Dianne Feinstein, nor their willingness to support the policies of every Israeli prime minister since they were elected to Congress. On December 18th, however, on the eve of Congress's holiday break, both joined eight other Senate committee chairs, among them Carl Levin and Ron Wyden, who, like Boxer and Feinstein, are Jewish, also with impeccable pro-Israel credentials, who did something no one could have expected. They stepped forward to sign a letter opposing a new Iran sanctions bill, the Nuclear Free Iran Act of 2013, or S-1881, authored by AIPAC, that Senators Robert Menendez, Democrat from New Jersey, and Mark Kirk, Republican from Illinois, were at that moment circulating among their Senate colleagues in search of additional co-sponsors, and doing so in open defiance of President Obama's expressed wishes. Perhaps because of the senator's letter, the number of senators who have signed on as co-sponsors of the Nuclear Free Iran Act has stalled at 59, all but 15 Republicans. Thus, it is 8 short of the 67 required to override a presidential veto that, for the first time, President Obama personally threatened to do last night near the end of his State of the Union address. No American president, it should be noted, has ever vetoed a piece of pro-Israel legislation, and only one previously, George Herbert Walker Bush, had threatened to do so. That was back in 1991, when another intransigent Israeli Prime Minister, Yitzhak Shamir, refused to accept Bush's request for a four-month delay and Israel's request for $10 billion in loan guarantees, and refusing to stop Russian Jews from settling in the West Bank. In that case, Bush appealed to the American public in a televised address in the White House, and when polls showed everything, the American public overwhelmingly supporting his position, Congress and AIPAC backed off. In recent months, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has made no secret of his objections to the U.S. and the other Security Council members, the P5 plus one, negotiating with Iran. It is clearly his agenda that AIPAC is following, despite President Obama's public and private appeals to members of the Senate and his warning that approval of new sanctions by Congress at this time would cause Iran to walk away from the negotiations. In unveiling the Nuclear Weapon-Free Iran Act, Senator Menendez declared that the bill would help, quote, achieving a meaningful diplomatic resolution, end quote. But as Peter Beinart pointed out in Haaretz, January 15th, in determining the impact of new sanctions on the chances of a nuclear deal, it's not Menendez's interpretation that counts, it is Iran's. And last December, he wrote, when the journalist Robin Wright asked Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif how his government would respond if Congress imposes new sanctions, even if they don't go into effect for 6 months, his reply was blunt. The entire deal is dead, he said. The current standoff in Washington was apparently totally unforeseen in Israel. Jerusalem was led to believe that the new sanctions bill is not a question of if, but rather one of when and what exactly, wrote former Haaretz correspondent Shmuel Rosner in the LA Jewish Journal. Congress is going to pass the bill, Israeli officials told me, he added, based on what they heard from American friends, including congressmen and senators. But like what happened to Jerusalem officials with other Iran-related matters, he goes on, they soon discovered that the American position is more elusive than they previously thought. It is not just that the Obama administration that is disappointing the Israeli government in not taking a tough stance on Iran, acknowledged Rosner. It is also the American Congress, end quote. Congress? Well, from past history, one would say that is next to impossible. Just last May 22nd, by a 99-0 vote, the Senate passed an almost identical resolution, S-65, which called on Obama, quote, to reiterate your readiness to take military action against Iran if it continues its efforts to acquire a nuclear weapon, and, like the latest one, an identical language urge, quote, that if the government of Israel is compelled to take military action in legitimate self-defense against Iran's nuclear weapons program, the United States government should stand with Israel and provide, in accordance with United States law and the constitutional responsibility of Congress to authorize use of military force, diplomatic, military, and economic support to the government of Israel in its defense of its territory, people, and existence, end quote. To cover their backs, the sponsors of both S-65 and S-1881 added a disclaimer noting that, quote, nothing in this resolution shall be construed as an authorization for the use of force or declaration of war, end quote, although those reading it could be justified in believing it was nothing less than that. That was clearly acknowledged by Senator Feinstein, chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee. In what was surely the finest moment of her political career, Feinstein first committed the heresy in Israel's eyes of suggesting that Iran could one day, like her other old enemies, she's named Germany and Japan, become America's friend. Then she pointed out that, quote, the fact is we have reached agreement and that action is just about to take place and we are going to jaundice it, we are going to hurt it, and we are likely to collapse it by passing additional sanctions now which a president of the United States will veto with the aim of overriding that veto. How does that make any kind of common sense, she asked. It defies logic. It threatens instant reverse and it ends what has been unprecedented diplomacy. Do we want to take that on our shoulders, she asked. Candidly, in my view, it is a march toward war, end quote, Senator Dianne Feinstein. How did this remarkable change come about? Jim Loeb of Interpress News Service points to a grassroots lobbying campaign carried out by nearly 70 grassroots religious anti-war and civic action groups that flooded the offices of nervous Democratic senators with thousands of emails, petitions, and phone calls, as well as endorsements of the administration's position by major national and regional newspapers, including the New York Times. Virtually everybody, he writes, but the neoconservative faction of the U.S. foreign policy elite, which has been pushing the U.S. toward a confrontation with Iran after successfully getting the U.S. to invade Iraq and depose Saddam. Loeb wrote that, quote, the White House won a clear victory over AIPAC and thus raised anew the question of just how powerful the group really is, end quote. What he and others asking the same question may have forgotten, however, is that all of the sanctions legislation up to now against Iran, as well as that which crippled Iraq and targeted Syria and Libya, were widely acknowledged to be the work of AIPAC. Moreover, this fight is far from over. AIPAC is going to have its national conference in Washington from March 1st to 4th, in which half the members of Congress usually attend, including half the Senate, and AIPAC will make a major push then. Also, in the last few days, the ubiquitous Dennis Ross, who has served as a Middle East expert and sometimes peace negotiator for the last four presidents, and who has been described as Israel's lawyer by his colleague Aaron David Miller, has been busy putting his influence behind the new sanctions legislation. Now, as senior counselor at the AIPAC spawn Washington Institute for Near East Policy, Ross has written an op-ed piece for Politico in Washington calling for passage of the legislation and co-authored a critical analysis of the preliminary Iran agreement with JINSA, the neocon Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, which Colin Powell later blamed for the Iraq War. That analysis, the second one issued by JINSA, is clearly intended to persuade Democrats in the Senate who have not yet signed on to the bill and may be thinking of future campaign donations to do so. It's characterized by an arrogance of tone and hypocrisy, accusing Iran of being as devious and dishonest as was Israel 50 years ago when it lied to President Kennedy and to the world about its nuclear weapons program. The JINSA analysis makes no reference to Israel's estimated several hundred nuclear weapons. And then, in what must be the height of chutzpah, the JINSA report notes that, quote, all task force members agree an acceptable final deal must require Iran to meet all of its international legal obligations, come clean about its past nuclear weapons research and work, and accept a much more intrusive inspections regime. Given that the agreement grants Iran greater concessions than it extracts, it goes on, which is simply not true, and, quote, considering how close Iran is to a nuclear weapons capability, again with no evidence, it goes on, it's critical such a final permanent deal which fulfills our principles be put in place as soon as possible, preferably before the JPA, that's the Joint Plan Agreement, six-month interim expires. And the nitty-gritty? The United States should move immediately to impose new sanctions and consider even tougher sanctions against Iran if no acceptable final agreement is in place 180 days after its formal implementation on January 20th. Finally, in a section headlined Boost the Credibility of the Military Option, the report says, quote, the United States must reinforce its leverage while pursuing any deal by making military action more credible. This requires more forceful U.S. declaratory policy to include clear support for Israel's right to defend itself, emphasizing advanced U.S. military capabilities, namely the GBU, Massive Ordnance Penetrator Bunker Buster, for neutralizing a deeply buried Fordo facility, and playing up, not down, the viability of military action in official statements. The United States must also begin military deployments to convey concretely its readiness to execute a preventive strike, end quote. That's just a small part of the JINSA report, which you're not likely to hear or read about anywhere else, but you could find it, however, on its website. If these people, beginning with Dennis Ross, do not fit the definition of an enemy fifth column, I'm not sure what does.